and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that. Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a screen guy.
Oh, Pennsylvania, we love Pennsylvania.
Less than a week ago, Pittsburgh voters went to the polls, and incumbent mayor Bill Peduto came up short. Pittsburgh is poised next year to have its first black mayor in history, with State Representative Ed Gainey. We're sitting down today with Councilwoman Erica Strasburger. She's a neighbor of Bill Peduto and a close political ally. So as the dust is still settling, she's kind enough to share with us her journey from environmental activism to electoral politics, and some of the highlights and the lowlights of the last 3 years serving on city council. She also has some very specific hypotheses on what happened last Tuesday and what all this might mean for next year's U.S. Senate primary.
First to that historic upset, State Representative Ed Gainey winning Pittsburgh's Democratic primary, paving the way to become the city's first African-American mayor.
Councilwoman Erica Strasburger, welcome to my kitchen table.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have been on council for more or less 3 years, a historic 3 years. But tell folks maybe your background before getting onto council.
So I actually come from an advocacy background. I worked as an environmental advocate for about 4 years in New Hampshire, working for Environment New Hampshire, and then 5 years in Pittsburgh for Penn Environment. And we were an organization that was pretty political, not election always oriented, but political in the sense that we were trying to pass laws at the state and federal level. And by 2008, realized that the best way to do that was to also be engaged in elections and helping to elect pro-environment leaders. So like a lot of other organizations, we jumped in the independent expenditure role, and I was spending time, you know, every election, taking time off my regular advocacy work and helping to elect pro-environment leaders, and was really, really engaged in New Hampshire in the 2008 elections and ever since then. So I did have some background in kind of in advocacy and lobbying and organizing and also electoral politics. And then after 5 years of working on issues that were really bubbling up at the time around gas drilling, around fracking in the Pittsburgh region, and becoming a national expert on that, and having worked in the environmental arena for about a decade, I was really excited and energized by Pittsburgh and what I saw happening in Pittsburgh, and really wanted to be involved in issues on the local level, not just on environmental sustainability and progress and changing our region for the better in that way, but so many other things that I saw happening. This was, you know, 2013. And when our current mayor, Mayor Peduto, somewhat unexpectedly won his primary that May, and his chief of staff, Dan Gilman, won the council seat for District 8, which is what I now represent. I saw that as an opportunity as an entry point, maybe to work in local government. And I've been doing a lot of soul searching around what I wanted my next move to be, but local government seemed like it could be it. So I got a position as chief of staff for then Councilman Gilman and worked for him for 4 years. Right after he was elected to his second term, he was called to go work for the mayor as his chief of staff. And I had about a week to decide if I wanted to run for his position, and took the plunge, you know, no regrets. I didn't want to regret not doing something. So I ran a really intensive 3-month campaign January to March of 2018, and had 3 other opponents and won. So I've been working in this job since then.
Thank you on 2 different levels. One, I'm a huge fan of Senator Jeanne Shaheen. And if my math serves me, that was your first run in 2008 for Senate. So you played a role in that. And I'm a fan of Penn Environment as well. So just so our listeners understand, you're born and raised in Pittsburgh, or you're from New England, or?
Neither. So I am born and raised in the Bay Area in California. And I think the strangest part about my story is that I came out to Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania, for college.
I always wonder about people who leave California, Erica. But okay.
Well,
you know, look, as Pennsylvania loses population, we like transplants. So
it is a strange story, but you know, the grass is always greener when you have parents who grew up in Pennsylvania and you have summers visiting it as a California kid. You romanticize it, right? The seasons, the snow, the brick buildings. And I wanted to try it and I ended up staying, and it wasn't totally by choice. I thought eventually I'd end up back in California, but 4 years in Central PA at Bucknell University and then up in New Hampshire for my first job. My husband is from Pittsburgh. So we met in New Hampshire, and when he was looking for a law career, it was the bottom of the economy. It was 2008, and he wanted to be where he knew he could, you know, at least have a chance of getting a job when no jobs were available. And I said, okay, I'll give Pittsburgh a chance. I'll give two years of Pittsburgh, and then I'm making a decision as to whether I move back to California. And before 2 years were up, I knew I wanted to stay here. It's a better quality of life, and it is. You know, I understand now why you can't go in a room of Pittsburghers, or even have two people who are from Pittsburgh in a room together without them just like talking about Pittsburgh for about a half an hour. There's such pride in the city, and there's good reason for it.
Well, I mean, it's definitely been, looking back over the last decade that you've lived there, I mean, it's a tremendous renaissance that's happened. So maybe give listeners a sense of the neighborhood that you live in and the communities that you represent.
Sure.
Pittsburgh very much is a city of diverse neighborhoods.
Yeah, we have 90 neighborhoods. I represent District 8, which is in the east end of Pittsburgh. And that's a big, big area. But the part of the east end I represent, I live in Squirrel Hill. I live about a stone's throw away from the heart of Squirrel Hill, which is the Forbes and Murray corridor, the commercial corridor. So I represent part of Squirrel Hill. I represent all of Shadyside, part of Oakland, and part of Point Breeze. And I would say Squirrel Hill is a vibrant residential neighborhood that feels almost like a suburb, but it's in the city. It's a bus ride away from downtown. It has its own little commercial district, and it's vibrant. And it's where our biggest Jewish population lives. It's probably one of our most ethnically diverse populations. And it's just up the hill from all the colleges and universities, which are in, not all of them, a few of our largest universities, Pitt and Carnegie Mellon, which are in Oakland. And those are all both in my district as well. And then we have Point Breeze, which is mostly residential. And we have Shadyside, which is a mix of residential and institution and commercial. And I would say that, you know, it's the wealthiest area in the city. It's the highest socioeconomic status. And it is where, you know, when Pittsburgh was really at its peak in the Gilded Age in the 1890s to 1950s, it's where the big, you know, the big owners of all the companies, the steelmakers, lived, where their mansions were. So we have, you know, when people say, oh, my neighborhood's gentrifying, like our neighborhood's gentrified in the 1890s and kind of have been there ever since. And I see it as a particular role to play, because when things happen, when things develop, I mean, they're going to develop maybe more quickly, closer to the universities, closer to those, to the hospitals, closer to those power centers. And I see it as my particular role to ensure equity and look a little bit more citywide rather than trying to just keep everything in the district. And I do that as I can in my role.
So your council district, I'll admit I'm from the other half of the state, from Lehigh County originally, but Your council district's been in the national news then over your tenure for both good and bad. You know, that awful October morning with Tree of Life, which sounds like it's within walking distance of your house, and then very different national news media attention with the 2020 election and the rallies and energies that brought toward the tail end of the campaign. So if you could speak to both of those looking back over the last 3 years on council.
Yeah, it has been such a whirlwind for those reasons and more. So I was elected March of 2018. October 2018 was when 11 of our neighbors were murdered by a hateful gunman who came into the synagogue, the Tree of Life Synagogue, where three different congregations were hosting their services, and killed 11 of our Jewish neighbors while they were praying. And yeah, that was three blocks from my house at the time. I have since moved, but it's still three blocks from my current house. And at the time, I was also 4 months pregnant. So there was a lot happening at once, right? And it was just surreal, to say the least, to see your backyard in the international news and the news, to get a call from the New York Times while you're still sheltering in place. I was actually about to go canvass for a fellow candidate, you know, for a female candidate for state rep. And we were all together a block away from the site. And, you know, it was people doing their civic duty, getting out to door knock and canvass for a fellow candidate. And we were huddled together and getting a call from the New York Times within a half an hour and not having any info for them. So it was terrible. It was a terrible tragedy. And out of that, I think, you know, we saw Squirrel Hill come together. We saw Pittsburgh come together. And that was something that, you know, we hadn't seen in a really, really long time in terms of the unity, the citywide unity across neighborhoods. And I would say that that was then, you know, Pittsburgh means different things to different people, but for so many people outside of the city, outside of the region, it means it is the representation of a phoenix rising from the ashes, you know, the steel industry collapsing in 1979 and through the 80s, mass exodus of working people, working age people, a whole generation basically lost to the region because there weren't jobs to be had anymore. And then a rebuilding in the 90s and the early 2000s where our riverfronts came back and our cultural district where the theaters and formerly red light district turned back into theaters and culture and plays and restaurants and downtown. So many different things happened in that time thanks to our philanthropic community and our eds and meds, as they like to say, the educational institution and medical institutions. And so for that reason, presidential candidates and presidents love coming to Pittsburgh because we represent a certain sort of success story, or at least we're on the road to success as an Appalachian city. We're really fortunate to have that status as a place that, you know, presidential candidates like to visit and sort of a bellwether area.
Thank you for helping foster unity and combat hate. It's a dreadful day that we should never forget. We should learn the lessons from. With an eye to 2020, I mean, obviously it was a very different campaign. For starters, university students that you referenced, there was no in-person learning, the rallies and such, door-to-door campaigning. But, you know, I'd be curious kind of what the weeks and months leading up to last November were like for you and your constituents and very politically charged, albeit Democratic, but politically charged environment.
Yeah, you know, there's a feeling in the district I represent that we're in a bubble and there's an acknowledgement, but there's not a whole lot of a political bubble and a sort of ideological bubble. And there are certain people who will seek out conversation, real conversation with people who live 20 miles outside of the city who have vastly different politics. But I felt like there were the one thing that I noticed is that people in the district I represent were much more attuned to the feelings and the thoughts of those who live elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the country than they had been in a while. And it was out of fear. It was out of self-preservation for some people who, you know, were felt like their lives, you know, through discrimination and through hate were being threatened by the continuation of this, you know, this former president. And there was, yeah, I mean, just the people that I knew that were doing the most were the people who were actually not even associated with our formalized structures. They were just people who were recently politicized, maybe from 2016, maybe from 2018, who were the go-tos for me too. I'm doing my work day to day. I'm kind of mired in the details, and they were the ones who I would go to and say like, "Hey, I have some time. Can I pick up the postcards and do some postcards? Hey, I have some time. Where's my best place to plug in?" So I found that was so interesting that it was a truly grassroots effort, at least from what I saw. It was people who were, again, not part of the Democratic Party structure or Republican Party structure. It was people operating outside of that who just cared a whole lot. And there was just an incredible amount of energy of people doing anything they could to actually step outside the neighborhood and outside the region and win this for Biden.
Well, on many levels, thank you. I mean, the turnout was tremendous in the city of Pittsburgh, and you know, thank goodness the electoral votes flipped. Yeah, I'm curious, in those final weeks last fall, were you hearing amongst these activists and these diehard True Blue volunteers talk of the mayor's race and, you know, what was on the horizon?
Not at all. Not at all. There was not an overt kind of discussion or recognition of that.
At what point, was it January, or at what point did you get the sense that this, you know, that there was potentially going to be a challenger to Mayor Peduto, who is a resident of your district? And, you know, were you sensing, in other words, something bubbling up?
I absolutely was. And so I would say that while the weeks leading up to the 2020 elections, there wasn't much talk about the mayor's race. It was actually more of a conversation last summer, in the summer of 2020. And, you know, just as a recent Vice news story, previous reporter from Pittsburgh put together, which I think was really kind of the perfect title for this kind of theme, the George Floyd murder changed the mayoral race in Pittsburgh. Just like it was sort of a tinderbox for so many different feelings and thoughts. And it was just, you know, this event that had ripple effects around the world. So too was that true for Pittsburgh mayoral race.
If I could just interject, we fortunately we're up to about 3,000 listeners, but honestly, not so many from the city of Pittsburgh. So if you can just give folks a little snapshot of what you're referring to last summer with the events on the
ground. Sure. So just like other cities all across the country, we saw, you know, the entire people from all 90 neighborhoods turn out to protests in different parts of the city every weekend. And the first in June, the protests were larger, and it was families, it was people of all races, all ethnicities coming together, younger, older. It was a really incredible sight, and unlike anything I've ever seen. And the people who are born and bred Pittsburghers, you know, they had never seen that. And that's what we experienced across the country, right? It was a new kind of unity here, a new kind of energy, and a lot of anger. And people who had been cooped up all year, people who had lost jobs, people who had lost friends and family to COVID, right? It was this really just, like I said, a tinderbox waiting to be lit. And that was it. And
I've had people describe it, obviously very, very different, but like when the Steelers and the Penguins have won the Super Bowl and the Stanley Cup, that kind of surge of people on the streets from all different backgrounds, but obviously for a very different reason.
Bigger than a Penguins Stanley Cup parade down Grand Street. Absolutely. It was that kind of turnout. So and I would say that the majority of events, not all of them, but the majority of these peaceful protests were in the district I represent or adjacent to them, really close by. I think part of the reason for that was they wanted to call attention to the areas adjacent to the district I represent that are quickly gentrifying, where we have a racially segregated city because of historical and, you know, not so long ago land use decisions that were made, where Black people feel like they're being pushed out of the city because of price increases and gentrification. And so I think that's part of the reason why, you know, they were concentrated near the district I represent. And I would say that, you know, this is where, again, across the country, the tactics that police have used to, you know, from their words, protect order, protect public safety. If they're getting, you know, if 99.9% of the protesters are peaceful, but they're getting word that there are people there ready for violence, you know, what's their reaction? Well, it's to suit up and wear masks and not tell people that there's a threat there, but be ready for when that happens or if that happens. In most cases, it doesn't. But in some cases, you know, the peaceful protesters leave and then others are left behind and they can't tell which ones are going to really incite violence and which ones are just going to throw a water bottle, which is pretty harmless. And so the people who were out and about, it just escalated. It just escalated, escalated. And I, you know, I see the police doing what they've always done and being surprised that this time people were fighting back. People were not having any of it. People were, you know, saying, why are you out here escalating the situation when you could be out here just protecting us or, you know, staying far away and coming in as needed or, you know, not coming in with riot gear and with masks. And there were a couple of different incidents and the mayor responded in a way that, you know, he felt like he had to. He has 1,000 police, 900 police officers who are his employees as an executive of the city. Those are his employees. And he feels a need to defend the ones who are doing, you know, nothing wrong according to what they had been trained to do. And then he has a whole full of angry people who are saying, you know, something needs to change in policing and it has to happen now. And so it was a wake up call for, you know, for a lot of people, including folks on Pitt City Council. I immediately, you know, I remember all of June, all of July, all of August, I was reading The End of Policing, and I was reading, you know, all these articles, and my team and I were pulling together research, and we put together an 8-page white paper on what we could do to change policing and public safety at different levels of government. And at the same time, dealing with a very strong police union, which makes it difficult to make some at least, you know, minor changes in terms of staffing, and it makes it difficult to fire the police officer who's had 57 complaints lodged against him because the police union will just get him rehired through arbitration. So the mayor was in a position where he was, yeah, I think doing what he could to try to keep all parties happy. And in doing so, made a lot of people angry, made a lot of people who were angry, who were, you know, feeling dissatisfied in his sort of centrist viewpoint of, well, we're going to tackle public safety, we're going to tackle policing, but you kind of, you know, need to let us do that over the course of the next few years. And that was a factor for sure. So police protests ended up at his house pretty frequently over the summer and through the fall and even into the winter, to the point where he was not able to stay there most evenings. And, you know, and then even his neighbors were split. Some of his neighbors were wanting the police to come in and just round up all the protesters and get them out of there because they're making noise at 1 a.m. and scaring their children. And others were saying, nope, they're welcome here. Don't try to kick them out. So a lot of unity followed by a lot of, you know, division in our city.
So in the city of Philadelphia, police and other city employees need to live within the city limits. Is it the same in Pittsburgh?
It is not. There was it actually went to referendum. It was voted on, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago. Majority of Pittsburgh voters voted that they did indeed have to live in the city limits. The police union appealed and they won. So now police are, I believe, the only city employees who are allowed to live outside of the city of Pittsburgh.
I didn't know that. Did you get a sense of the protesters? Because there is a narrative on social media, which is always a rabbit hole, and I try not to go down. But protesters local to Pittsburgh, or folks were coming in from elsewhere?
Hard to say. I mean, the Pittsburgh region. So I think that many were coming in from inner ring and outer ring suburbs, but I don't think we were getting busloads of people from another region. I think it was people who claimed Pittsburgh as their hometown.
Let's look. We're less than a week after the primary. The dust is settled, and I commend the county employees who counted those ballots so quickly. I mean, 2020 hindsight. Is this the issue that dominated the election and is going to dominate the next 4 years? Or are there other public policy issues that you're hearing both in council and amongst politicos and people on the street?
I think that that we're just a microcosm of what's happening worldwide. And I think that it comes down to some fundamental issues that need to be paid attention to and communicated around. And it can't just be policies. It has to be around the communication too. Inequity is one of them. So just all the different issues that flow from the vast and historic inequity that we're facing in this country and in this world right now. And that's, I'm talking about economic inequity, but that's also now then tied up in racial inequity as well. So when we talk about that, then that's then related to policing. And I think that it's yet to be seen whether we see a summer of protests again or not, based on policing. But I don't think it's going to be, I don't think that policing, I think policing will stay on the front burner for a while, but I don't see it being the issue that remains on the front burner for the next 4 years. I think there will be many different versions of this kind of policy issue popping up, but it's going to be different each time. This time it was policing, and it was policing specifically around racial inequity in policing and racial inequity in all aspects of policing, whether it's the number of traffic stops or it's the number of, you know, the disproportionate number of times that people of color are asked to leave their, you know, get out of their vehicle or shot and killed, you know. So that is one aspect of inequity. I think another is, you know, how willing are elected officials to take on the big entities in town, right? In some cases, it's going to be in Washington, it's probably going to be like the big tech companies, and in Palo Alto, that in San Francisco, that's going to be the big question. Are you willing to take on the big tech companies? In Seattle, same. Are you going to make them pay their fair share in taxes? Are you going to make them improve their, you know, working conditions? Are you going to allow them to organize and form a union? And in Pittsburgh, the big entities aren't so much the big tech companies, although we do have a presence in Pittsburgh of Google and autonomous vehicle technology testing and robotics and all sorts of great stuff. But we also have some major nonprofits that are some of the biggest employers, and they're in the eds and meds. There are major nonprofits that, if you didn't know better, you'd think they were corporations. And we have, you know, schools, and under state law, they classify as nonprofits, which, while they pay many different types of taxes, are exempt from paying property tax. And that's long been a sticking point in Pittsburgh, and something that really the state legislature needs to change. But there's been a case made in the past that we could file a lawsuit as the city of Pittsburgh and force the largest nonprofit, UPMC, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, to, you know, at the very least take them on in a lawsuit and try to force them to pay, try to force them out of their nonprofit status or challenge their nonprofit status. And that became, I think, a really big factor in this race as well.
Well, you've been super generous with your time, Councilwoman, and that topic deserves its own series of podcasts. Look, it's been a long, emotional, probably sleepless week. So once again, thank you. I saw the Philadelphia Inquirer and others outside of Pittsburgh have written stories about what does all this portend? Is it the rise of the progressive Pennsylvania's version of the Squad and the Sanders campaign? So I guess with a final question with an eye to 2022. Where it's shaping up, at least in the Senate race, that it's going to be hopefully not too divisive and contentious, but it is going to be a heck of a primary. What advice would you give folks from outside the city of Pittsburgh? Currently, we don't have any statewide candidates from Pittsburgh who are looking to get to know the activists and the volunteers, the constituents you represent.
Yeah, the dust is still settling a little bit, and I probably would give you a different answer 2 weeks from now, even. But what I'm the major lessons learned so far is that I'm thinking about are the politics, the electioneering as we've done it in the past, contacting the super voters, focusing on a smaller universe of voters, you know, who you expect are going to vote. You got to pay attention to the new voters. The wild card is the new voters. And if you ignore them, they're probably not going to be with you. So pay attention to those new voters, whether they're younger voters, whether they're just unlikely voters. I think a lot of them are younger, and a lot of younger people are getting mobilized and energized by candidates who can speak their language and speak to them on platforms that they're familiar with. It almost doesn't matter how many policy proposals you've succeeded in, how much you've accomplished, whether it's big or small. If you can't communicate that, if you can't choose the ones that are going to be the issues that people care about and can communicate those in a really effective way in a bunch of different ways, in person, on platforms, social media platforms, and in the news media, you're not going to get their attention on that. So I would say those two things. Don't discount the new voters, and, you know, figure out a way to be strategic about how you communicate your accomplishments or your vision. Because increasingly, you know, people aren't digging into the details or not reading the articles. They're reading the headlines, and they're using their gut instinct to figure out how they're going to, you know, vote and support their candidates.
Sage advice. Well, thank you so much, Councilwoman.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you all so much for listening to today's episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. As Hillary Clinton used to say, it takes a village. This podcast would not be possible without the help of Sarah McGrath and Jake Schwartz. If you liked this discussion, we would love for you to give us a review, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a suggestion on a future guest and other feedback, visit our website, papoliticspodcast.org. Don't forget to follow us on social media at PA Political Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn.